Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of a bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack, which it's firmly in my wheelhouse and probably, well, in Lockie's too, because of the years that we're talking about. And this is going to be fun. This is always fun talking about this subject, isn't it, Lockie?
It is. I feel like if I didn't have a broken leg, I'd be standing in the presence of royalty. I've got two renowned royal historians with me today. In fact, joining us, we've got Corin Hall, historian, broadcaster, specialises in the Romanovs. So it's Russian royalty is the specialisation. And there's quite a lot of R's here. There might even be some R's.
Yeah.
In fact, with the subject material. I'm not going to get Boney M stuck in anyone's head, hopefully. But the Romanovs and European monarchy. Corin's books include Little Mother of Russia and Once a Grand Duchess, Xenia, sister of Nicholas II. And she's here to talk to us about her latest book, which is Rasputin's Killer and His Romanov Princess. Hello, Corin.
Hello.
Welcome. Welcome to History Hack. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes. Looking forward to this, actually.
Good. Yeah, well, so am I. I mean, it is kind of in my wheelhouse. Well, I talk about 1917 a lot. And so 1917 is part of the story here, isn't it? We're going to go a little bit further and a little bit further east for me. We need to talk about a little bit of context, maybe, possibly. And so Russia, then, who was the richest man in Russia? And how did he and someone called Irina come together?
Well, he was Prince Felix Yusupov, and his mother, Princess Zinaida, inherited a fortune, 40 estates, fortune in artworks, a fortune in jewels, and they were said to be wealthier than the Romanovs. But Felix was rather a disreputable character. He grew up undisciplined. He wasn't even born the heir. The heir was his older brother. And his older brother led him into a rather loush lifestyle of dressing as a woman and going to nightclubs dressed as a woman and all this sort of thing. So Felix got rather a bad reputation. But in 1908, his brother was killed in a duel over a woman. And this left Felix as the only Yusupov heir. So, of course, he's under pressure to marry. But he's believed to be homosexual, so it wasn't really helpful. I think he was bisexual because he had feelings for certain women. There's a couple of women that he mentions in letters and memoirs that he did feel for, but they weren't suitable for marrying. But in 1910, while he was studying at Oxford University, he went to visit an exiled Romanov in London. And he saw on the mantelpiece a picture of the Tsar's very beautiful niece, Princess Irina. Now, Princess Irina was the daughter of a cousin of the Tsar, Grand Duke Alexander Mikhailovich, and his wife, the Tsar's sister, Grand Duchess Xenia. So Irina was their only daughter, their elder child, born in 1895. She had six brothers. She had a very sheltered upbringing, unlike Felix, governesses and chaperoned and all that sort of thing. But Felix was very struck by her beauty. And he was encouraged, really, by his mother to make this connection with the Romanovs because she thought, hey, we can't do better than that. The Yusupovs and the Romanovs, that would be a wonderful marriage. So she encouraged him at every turn. But Irina was drawn to him because she was very shy and she found she could talk to Felix the way she couldn't talk to other people. So a connection was formed, but it was frowned upon by a lot of people. As I said, Felix was believed to be homosexual. Grand Duke Dmitri wanted to marry Irina. He was the Tsar's cousin. And a lot of the imperial family would have favoured that marriage, including Irina's grandmother, the Dowager Empress. So really, Felix was almost a non-starter, but Irina wouldn't have anyone else. And when the engagement was announced, the imperial family was shocked. And Empress Alexandra said, I wouldn't let any of my daughters marry him. So anyway, they got their way. They were married in 1914, and they had one daughter, also called Irina, who was born in 1915. But she was always called Baby, never called Irina, to distinguish her from her mother.
We need to bring in another character, don't we, obviously. And he is a Siberian peasant who smells bad of his own volition and doesn't look very great either, and yet turns out to be quite magnetic, doesn't he? So in 1905, that's a fateful year, isn't it, where he comes into contact with the Russian royal family. How does he get from stinky Siberian peasant to people thinking that he's a lover of the Tsarina?
This is an interesting one, isn't it? And basically, the first thing you have to know is that in 1904, after 10 years of marriage, Empress Alexandra gives birth to a son, the long-awaited heir, because daughters were no good, they couldn't inherit the throne. But Alexei had hemophilia. And at that time, there was little the doctors could do. In fact, there was nothing they could do, and there was certainly no cure. And hemophilia is transmitted by the mother to only male children. So Alexandra felt guilty. And she turned to faith healers and holy men in the hope of finding a killer. And one of these holy men was Grigory Rasputin. As you said, he was a Siberian peasant. As a young man, he was a drunk and a lecher. But he also acquired a gift of prophecy and second sight. And in 1903, he visited St. Petersburg, and he attracted a lot of attention amongst influential churchmen, and he gained an entry into the salons of the nobility, and people actually believed that he was a holy man. And in 1905, one of the Grand Duchesses arranged for him to meet the Tsarina and the Tsar, and he became a regular visitor to the palace. And again, when Alexei had a hemophiliac crisis and he suffered a hemorrhage, Rasputin stopped the flow of blood by praying at his bedside. And the Tsarina became convinced that he was sent by God to save her son.
This is the thing, isn't it? He coincidentally is present for upturns in Alexei's health. So you cannot deny that there are occasions. And he definitely, at the very least, like in terms of being a homeopathic, he definitely makes the child feel calmer and better. Obviously, he's not magical, but she is very superstitious. Well, Russians in general are very superstitious, and she's an adopted Russian, but she is very religious and very superstitious. And she genuinely believes he has magic powers, doesn't she?
She generally believes that, and she wants to believe that, of course. She wants a cure for Alexei. And of course, she doesn't see the other side of him. She doesn't see him going to the nightclubs and behaving like a debauched peasant and getting drunk and all this sort of thing that he was doing in public. She only sees the holy side of him when he gets to the palace and he prays at the bedside. He then calms her down.
Yeah.
And her sense of calm, I think, is then transmitted to Alexei. I think it's something really only Russians can explain.
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest. The chances that he was actually diddling the Russian Empress they're zero, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's all very strange, but somehow it worked. And he calmed the Empress. The Empress is calm, is transmitted to the son. The bleeding starts slowing. Alexei starts getting better. And it happened time and time again. But the thing is, in Alexandra's eyes, Rasputin could do no wrong.
Yeah, so and that's the problem, isn't it? Because the bridge now to between what's going on inside the royal palaces, how does that transmit to the Russian people, and what does it do to the Romanovs, and what do they think of Rasputin? Because that's key to your story, isn't it?
Well, very few people knew about Alexei's illness for a start. It was a closely guarded secret. Even the Tsar's own sisters didn't find out what was wrong with him until 1912. So it was kept very much under wraps. So the people didn't know why this debauched peasant that they saw rollicking in nightclubs was at the palace. Alexandra couldn't understand why they sort of objected to a holy man coming. Well, this wasn't too bad until war broke out. And then Russia started suffering defeat after defeat. And in 1915, the Tsar decided to take command of the Russian army. So he left the front, leaving Alexandra in charge. And behind her was Rasputin. And as more and more ministers were dismissed and replaced by non-entities suggested by Rasputin, things went from bad to worse. And the people remembered Alexandra's German birth, and they believed she was spying for them and that she was helped by Rasputin, who was also a German spy. So scandalous stories began to circulate because the people could believe the only reason that Rasputin was there was because he was Alexandra's lover. It's the old rah-rah Rasputin, as you mentioned earlier, Andrew. Actually, I used that line on a chapter subtitle in the book. It was too good to miss. But because Alexei's illness was a closely guarded secret, nobody knew why Rasputin was there. And they believed these stories that he was Alexandra's lover. Something had to be done. And this was where Felix stepped in.
So forgive me. I mean, if Felix is, I'm going to tangent a little bit. If Felix is, I don't know, out of favour, his reputation is questionable. Why does he feel the need to involve himself quite so intensely?
Well, like a lot of other people, they believed, as I said, that Rasputin and the Empress were spying for the Germans. They called them the German Party. And this had to be stopped. The Empress wouldn't dismiss Rasputin. The Tsar wouldn't get rid of him because it would upset the Empress. He actually said rather one Rasputin than 10 fits of hysterics a day. He'd do anything to keep the Empress happy. And that involved keeping Rasputin. So they couldn't get rid of him any other way. So Felix and a few other people decided the only way to get rid of him was to kill him.
Yeah, so let's talk about that then. Okay, let's talk about the night itself.
Yes, now this is where it gets interesting. Felix got together a group of conspirators. There was the Tsar's cousin, Grand Duke Dmitri, who I mentioned earlier, who wanted to marry Irina. There was a member of the Russian Duma called Vladimir Pirishkevich, an army officer called Sergei Sukhotin, and Dr. Lazarev, an army doctor. Now, we only have the actual versions given by Felix and Pirishkevich, which roughly tally. And they say that Rasputin was lured to the Yusupov Palace. In the basement, he was offered poison cakes and poison wine. And after a while, the poison failed to work. Felix went upstairs, fetched a gun, and shot Rasputin in the side. But he wasn't dead. He escaped into a courtyard where he was pursued by Pirishkevich and shot in the back. Note, I say in the back. This is important. His body was then dumped in the frozen river Neva, where it was found under the ice 3 days later. But this version doesn't stack up. We now know there was no forensic evidence of poison, no evidence of solids in his stomach, and no water in his lungs. And latest research reveals that Rasputin was killed by a final gunshot to his forehead, which security experts say is the mark of an assassin. Now, it's now widely believed that the British Secret Intelligence Service, the SIS, were involved in the murder. And the reason for that is that Britain was afraid that Rasputin was plotting to persuade the Tsar to make a separate peace with Germany. And if that happened, it would release thousands more German troops onto the Western Front. One of Felix's friends from Oxford days was a man called Oswald Rayner, who was a member of the British SIS, based in Russia at the time. And I believe that the British government told Rayner to contact Felix. And there's a letter which was provided to me by the Yusupov Palace archives, where Rayner is writing to Felix to remind him of their former association, which was brief, actually, at Oxford, but brief enough to make contact. And according to a Rayner family member, Rayner was briefed in London by Mansfield Cumming, the chief of the SIS, who knew George V well. So basically, Rayner and John Scale, the senior British agent in Russia, had several meetings with Felix in the autumn of 1916 to plan the murder. And I found clues to Rayner's involvement in Rasputin's murder in letters he wrote to friends at Preston Manor in Brighton, letters to friends in Finland, and archives in Russia. And several people also later wrote that Rasputin's assassin was an Englishman. And in fact, Rayner's driver, William Compton, told his family that Rasputin's assassin was an Englishman, a lawyer, who came from the same area of the country as himself. And birth records show that Compton and Rayner, who described himself as a barrister at law, were born just 10 miles apart. And Rayner's family confirm he was in the Yusupov Palace that night. And Felix later said, apart from the five known members of the conspiracy, those culpable of this disappearance of Rasputin had to remain unknown, and he would never say more. Now, Rayner wasn't a professional assassin, and nothing can be proved, but many people now believe that he fired the fatal shot at point-blank range into Rasputin's forehead.
Wow.
Not to take in, isn't it?
It is a lot to take in. I would be sad to let go of the image of Yusupov repeatedly trying to kill this man and him going, ha-ha, like Hollywood style, when you think the baddie's dead in the horror film and then they suddenly spring up again and he seems, there's about three occasions of it.
We don't know exactly what happened, and that's the problem, you see. So many people have investigated this. There were three bullet shots to Rasputin, one in each side and the final one in the forehead that would have killed him instantly. I think it's pretty certain probably Felix fired the first one. Probably the second one was fired by Perishkevich, but it's the third bullet hole to the forehead that's the decisive one. And so many...
Step aside, amateurs.
Well, there's a retired police inspector who investigated this. One of the Secret Service experts, in fact, more than one, have investigated it. And they've all come to the conclusion that the evidence in Felix's memoirs doesn't stack up. It was just a cover story to hide what really happened. We don't know what exactly happened. We probably never will know exactly what happened, but it is indisputable that he was killed by three bullets and there was no poison, no poison cakes, no poison wine and all that sort of thing. And what Felix put in his memoirs was a cover story.
And yet, for decades, the story that we've just discussed, the cakes, the wine, the chasing him across the Petersburg, the he actually drowned in the Neva, he still didn't kill him. None of that killed him. That's what people believed for decades. So what is the aftermath of this like for Felix and Irina?
Well, none of them were prosecuted for a start. The Tsar didn't dare. Grand Duke Dmitry had immunity. As a member of the imperial family, he had immunity from prosecution. Felix's marriage to Irina gave him immunity as well, because his wife was a member of the imperial family. The palace couldn't be searched. So that was the other thing. Perishkevich, the only other man the police knew was present, they only knew about Felix and Perishkevich in the palace. They didn't know about the others. He quickly returned to the front on his hospital train and died of typhus in 1920. The Tsar banished Grand Duke Dmitry to the Persian front, and that saved his life, because he eventually escaped to England. Felix was banished to his remote hunting estate of Rakitnoy in Kursk province, where he was joined by Irina and his parents. Sukhotin died in Paris in 1926, and Dr. Lazarev died as late as 1976. So basically, Irina and Felix lived for about 2 or 3 months in Rakitnoy in sort of exile, not knowing how long this exile would last, until the Tsar abdicated and the imperial government was overthrown.
And that's when real calamity follows, isn't it, with the 1917 revolutions.
Yes.
So, I mean, some of them end up all over the place. How does the Bolshevik revolution affect them?
Well, the first thing, of course, is the February Revolution. Felix was pardoned. He was able to return to the capital, which at that time was called Petrograd. And he stayed there for a little while, but he realised it was a little bit unsafe. So he went to the Crimea, to a place called Koryz, which was one of the Yusupov estates down there. And his parents joined him. Irina joined him. Their child was there. And Irina's parents and her grandmother were down there at another estate nearby. So there are a whole lot of Romanovs down in the Crimea. But the provisional government began confiscating estates and private palaces, and Felix decided to return to Petrograd to hide the family jewels and works of art in specially constructed hiding places in their Petrograd and Moscow houses. The feeling was when the revolution was over and things settled down, they could return, live as before, find the artworks and carry on. But that didn't happen. He managed to bring out of Petrograd two Rembrandts cut from their frames and as much jewellery as he could safely carry. But by the time the Bolsheviks took power in October, the revolution had reached the Crimea and there were house searches, and Irina's parents and her grandmother were placed under house arrest, and things got quite serious. Irina and Felix weren't arrested. Irina's marriage to Felix counted as marriage to a commoner, believe it or not. So they weren't arrested. They were allowed to go free. But Soviet sailors were roaming the area. They were looting and plundering and murdering. But when they found that Felix had been the man who killed Rasputin, they let them go. They never bothered them anymore. So they were left alone, basically, by all these murderous, looting, rampaging Soviet sailors. Until in 1919, they were evacuated, along with Irina's grandmother, the Dowager Empress, her parents and other members of the family, on board HMS Marlborough, which was sent by King George V. And Felix took with him the two Rembrandts and some of the most famous jewels in Europe that he'd managed to smuggle out of his palaces. But this, of course, was only a fraction of their former wealth.
Yeah, it's a consistent story, isn't it? Impoverished Russian aristocrats across Europe after the...
That's right.
Felix and Dmitri end up falling out, don't they? Why?
Well, when Felix reached London in 1919, he began talking about the murder of Rasputin. But the conspirators had sworn an oath never to talk about it. And when Dmitri arrived in London in the early 1920s and heard about this, he got very upset. And he was angry because he'd never spoken about it to anyone. I mean, Dmitri's 1916 diary hasn't even survived. So there's nothing there that tells Dmitri's role in all this at all. He never spoke about it. He never wrote about it. And in 1927, he became even more angry because Felix published a book called Rasputin, His Malign Influence and His Assassination. And Dmitri accused him of breaking their oath of silence in order to make money, which of course was what he was doing actually. And they never spoke again. It was rather sad because in their youth, they had been very close and some even said that they were lovers. They were so close. But they just had this massive falling out. When Dmitri married, Felix never even attended the wedding.
So thinking about them and what they did afterwards then, I mean, I'm thinking of popular representations of Russian aristocrats in exile, and I'm thinking of the Peaky Blinders depiction of almost like a semi-criminal lifestyle under the veil of you know, former grandeur. What did they do? What did they get up to, the Yusupovs, while they were in exile?
Well, the first thing is, of course, they didn't expect the exile to last very long. They thought in a few months we'll be back on our estates, living like we did before, and everything will be fine. So they carried on spending money. Felix and Irina helped the Russian emigres wherever they could. There were a lot of people who didn't have even the wealth that they'd managed to bring out of Russia. There were people who'd run out of Russia with the clothes they stood up in. So they helped anyone they could. They moved to Paris, and in the 1920s, they opened a fashion house called Urfé, which if you look at it, is the first two letters of their Christian names, IR for Irina and FE with the accent for Felix. And that did very well. They had a lot of American clients who flocked over to see the Tsar's niece model the gowns because Irina had the sort of androgynous figure that was fashionable in the 20s. So she acted as a model for all the gowns that they designed. And of course the clients wanted to meet the man who killed Rasputin. So they did very well out of that for a while. They opened about three Russian restaurants in Paris as well, which did very well. So things were going all right. But in 1925, Felix lost the two Rembrandts that he brought out of Russia in a disputed case with an American dealer, which was heard in the US Supreme Court. It's very complicated, but basically Felix maintained that the paintings were mortgaged to this man that he could get them back. And the man insisted that they were sold to him, and Felix lost the case. So he lost the two Rembrandts. But while they went to America to hear this court case, and while they were there, they managed to sell some jewels to Cartier. So they had some money from that. But then in the 1930s, the Depression hit, and they lost all the American clients at Urfey because they didn't have the money to come over and buy the gowns. They had to close all their businesses to bail everything out. And of course, they lost the money that they'd had from the sale of jewels to Cartier in America. So things started to go wrong. Then to top it all, the Bolsheviks started finding the hiding places in the Moscow and St. Petersburg palaces where Felix had hid all the jewels and the works of art. He got hidden rooms, false ceilings, violins, Stradivarius violins hidden in columns in these palaces, thousands and thousands and thousands of works of art, millions of pounds in jewels came tumbling out. Under the staircase of the Moscow house, they found seven trunks filled with jewellery. Seven trunks. So a fortune in works of art and jewels was confiscated that Felix and Irina had hoped to retrieve, but now we're never going to get back. So then they had to start selling and pawning the jewels they brought out of Russia so that they could make ends meet. But the problem with that is that the market was now saturated with Russian jewels. Everybody was selling their jewellery. So they weren't getting as much as they'd hoped for the jewels.
I'm really keen to know. So obviously we've got all these pretenders, haven't we? And the most famous one of all is Anna Anderson, who claims to be the Tsar's daughter, Anastasia. How are they linked to this? This is a long drawn out saga, Anna Anderson claiming to be one of the lost Grand Duchesses. How do the Yusupovs find themselves embroiled in this?
Well, the real Anastasia was Irina's cousin. So Irina had played with the Tsar's daughters, Olga, Tatiana, Maria and Anastasia, when she was a child. And there's letters in the Russian archives between her and the Grand Duchesses, some of which I've got for the book, incidentally. So she was very close to them, especially to Olga and Tatiana, who were a similar age, but she knew Anastasia. So when in the 1920s, stories started circulating that Anastasia's escaped, you know, she's living in Germany, etc., etc. The imperial family who'd survived didn't believe it because they'd heard from the official investigation that all the Tsar's children were dead, along with the Tsar and the Tsarina. And Irina had had 17 members of her close family killed by the Bolsheviks. And it was three maternal uncles, two paternal uncles, five cousins, numerous other...
They're flinging them down mine shafts at one
point. Yes, that's right. They were, yes, yeah. Exactly. Some were flown alive down a mine shaft. The Tsar and his family were shot and bayoneted, as we know, at Ekaterinburg. So Irina was pretty traumatised by all this. She didn't want to know. But Felix decided to go and meet this woman, this Anna Anderson. So he went to Germany and he met her. But in a letter to a friend, he describes her as an adventuress, a sick hysteric and a frightful play actress. He didn't believe it. As I said, Irina never went to see her. She just found the whole thing all too traumatic. It kept recurring again and again all through their lives. And finally, in 1965, Felix actually testified against her in a tribunal at Hamburg court. And he issued a long statement. They visited him because he was too ill by then to travel. And a commission investigated him and took a long statement saying that she wasn't Anastasia. He could find no similarity between her and the real Grand Duchess, et cetera, et cetera. And in 1970, her claim was finally rejected in the court. So after Felix and Irina had died, or after Felix had died, certainly, her claim was finally rejected, but it took that long to sort it out. But yeah. Of course, the base for a lot of it was money, because so many people believed that the Tsar had money in a bank account, and if this Anna Anderson could get hold of the money, then they would all benefit from her doing so.
But yeah, I mean, we're talking about the days before DNA, aren't we? I mean, it's not until 1998, yes. Obviously, yes. That they finally managed to identify to start identifying the Tsar and everybody in that sort of in the woods. So a lot of it is down to play acting. I mean, she's not the only one that does this. She is the most famous. But I mean, there's the Tatiana that's quite prolific at one.
There was another Anastasia, several Alexis.
Yeah.
There were several of them. Going around Europe claiming to be one or the other of them. And I think, as I said, a lot of people think the basis of it was money, which wasn't actually there. So, you know, it's just dragged on and on and on. But Irina, as I said, didn't want to know, because the whole thing was so traumatic that these young girls she played with had been shot and bayoneted in a cellar in Ekaterinburg. So, you know, she just didn't want to know about it.
I mean, the real Anastasia, that she didn't die straight away, did she? There's the
account. She was bayoneted. That, yeah, that's right.
That they finished her off with bayonets. Mm. And obviously, oh, that theory isn't there, that it's because they had the jewellery sewn into their corsets and things, and it acted kind of as a bulletproof.
Well, that's right. They couldn't get the guards were wondering why they couldn't shoot them, and the bullets were ricocheting off. And of course, when they stripped them afterwards, they found all these jewels in the corsets, which were ricocheting the bullets away from the girls. So
there's some stuff in the Royal Archives from one of the guys that was in the firing squad and stuff, and he was messed up by the whole thing.
Literally,
he absolutely went to pieces mentally for obvious reasons, having participated in it. But it's all very gruesome.
Very gruesome, yeah. Very gruesome. And you can't wonder that Irina really didn't want to know, you know, about these young girls she played with meeting such a gruesome death like that. But
I just love that usually it's cats on Zoom. I love that Lockie's terrapin is basically dancing in the background.
Yeah, it's me. I wonder
look
what
at
it
me,
was.
Look at me.
That I was wondering what it was. Personality it, in a nutshell.
Yeah. He's all like, I want to be on Zoom too. And it's like, it's not just cats. Terrapin do it too. He's looking at it. He's really working it.
It's usually someone's cat crawling on the keyboard, isn't it?
Yeah.
he's all right. Mm. We'll get him out for a run around a little bit later and use some of that energy up, maybe. But he's he powers around.
Oh, there he is. I can see him now.
He's basically doing the running man in his tank, looking for attention. It's fantastic.
Just to bring it back to this, we can talk about Percy at length, but you've got this kind of weird duality, I guess, between some incredibly boring, practical, just lack of money stuff, and yet amazing stories to tell about the whole business. And I guess that thinking about ways for some of these aristocrats to, you know, make themselves a living after the financial, you know, stock market crash and you know, the lack of just the sheer lack of cash, and you think telling that story would be part of it, and even going off and to Hollywood and making films about some of these elements, and that did happen a little bit, didn't it? And we've talked about sort of legal problems for them, but they came to a head with them suing MGM, didn't they, at one point? What was that about?
Well, people started making films about Rasputin and Rasputin's death. And in 1932, around Christmas time, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer released a film called Rasputin and the Empress in New York. And it purported to tell the story of Rasputin's murder. And it really starred three huge Hollywood stars, Ethel John and Lionel Barrymore. And they were huge names at the time. And there's a key scene in the film when Rasputin hypnotized and then violated the Tsar's beautiful niece, Princess Natasha, in the film, whose fiancé, Prince Paul Chegadaev, murdered Rasputin in his cellar in revenge. Now, although the picture bore little relation to the actual facts, MGM made the mistake of putting a preface on the screen at the beginning of the film. And what it said was, "This concerns the destruction of an empire brought about by the mad ambition of one man. A few of the characters are still alive. The rest met death by violence." Now, everyone knew that Felix was married to the Tsar's niece and that he had killed Rasputin in the cellar. Irina was convinced that the violated character of Princess Natasha in the film was herself. Now, by this time, Felix and Irina had reached their lowest ebb financially. They'd pawned or sold most of their jewels, and the bailiffs were a constant threat in their lives. The film was being shown all over the world, damaging Irina's reputation because she had never met Rasputin. Even as a child, her father had instructed her governess, don't let her meet Rasputin when she goes to play with the Grand Duchesses. So Irina sued MGM for libel in the London Law Courts, and she won. It was a case that dragged on for a week or so. It transfixed society, was headlined in all the newspapers, and she got what was said to be the largest libel judgment in England for 300 years. They never disclosed the exact amount, but it undoubtedly was millions. And Irina put it into a trust fund so that her daughter would eventually later benefit from the money. So there you have it. And that's why now, and when you see these historical films, or not even historical ones sometimes, you see right at the end a little disclaimer that says any relation to persons living or dead is entirely coincidental, or words to that effect. And I call it the Yusupov disclaimer myself, because you see it at the end of a lot of things these days. You watch when the film ends and you'll find it there, if there's any likelihood that it concerns anyone who could think it could be them.
I think the people who make The Crown are probably massively grateful for the ability to use that disclaimer, even though they're lying to their teeth when they
do. Yes, that's right.
You mentioned failing health a little while ago. Talk to us about the end of their lives, Felix and Irina.
Well, they kept a low profile after the MGM court case because, of course, the war broke out and Paris was occupied by the Germans. And really, Irina's Romanov name could have been used as propaganda. So they kept a very, very low profile. They later, after the war, became briefly part of the social circle of the Duke of Windsor, Irina's cousin, and his wife, Wallis Simpson.
My favourite people.
Yeah. And they sort of lived there, going into their Paris house. They sort of had the lifestyle that they left behind in Russia, you know, with all the servants and the gold. And
them two hanging around with inappropriate company? Never.
Yeah.
So, we're back on the louche lifestyle and debauchery, are we?
Yes, something like that, yeah. So Felix also tried turning his hand to faith healing. He didn't do it very well, I have to say. He wasn't very successful. He wrote his memoirs, Lost Splendor, which were published in 1952. And really, he regained ownership of a family chateau in Brittany as well. He fought through the courts for years for that, after he found that the conditions of the donation of the property to the Department of Finisterre had been broken. And he fought through the courts and got ownership of the chateau back. So he was able to sell that. So money from the sale of the chateau, money from royalties for his memoirs, income from Irina's trust. They had a lifestyle, really, that most Russian emigres never had. They were fairly comfortable, despite the fact they'd lost all the massive wealth that they had. He sued a couple of other production companies over films about Rasputin, but this time he lost. And he had a couple of strokes in the 1960s, and he died in 1967 in Paris after a stroke. And Irina died in 1970. She survived him for 4 years, and one of her cousins stepped into the breach and sort of kept her company, invited her to Biarritz, invited her to stay and this sort of thing. And she died early in 1970 in Paris. And strangely enough, her death was to do with cats, because she loved cats and she liked to feed the strays that came to the house. And one morning she opened the back door hearing this meowing, and she was only in her negligee. And it was a cold February morning, and she went out and fed the cat, and she caught a cold. And the cold turned to pneumonia and she died. And it was to do with feeding the cats.
That's a really sad end.
It is, isn't it? But the strange thing is, there's supposed to be a curse on the Yusupovs laid by Rasputin that the heir would always be a daughter. And I have to say that up until this time, as far as I'm aware, no sons have been born in that family since Felix in 1887. That's rather strange.
People know me. Was the cat okay?
I'm sure it was. She loved to feed the cats. She had cats.
Someone else feed the cat after she died. This is my fixation.
I expect so. Don't forget. She had a servant.
Okay. I'm going to convince myself that the cat lived happily ever after.
I'm sure it did. Yeah. She fed all the stray cats. You know, she'd hear them meowing, go to the back door and go and feed the cats. She loved cats.
I like her, even if she did hang out with Wallis Simpson.
There's a lovely picture in the book of her with a cat, actually, which you'll like.
Oh, I'm going to track that down. I think these are figures I don't know very much about, but they all seem very likable, actually. I mean, we've got a killer here, but quite a likable one, it seems.
Yeah, he wasn't a bad man at all. He was doing what he thought was a patriotic act. I mean, he thought killing Rasputin was a patriotic act. The Empress would have a nervous breakdown. The Tsar would send her to the Crimea or a convent or somewhere out of the way, and Russia would be ruled properly. They didn't expect the revolution to come like that and overturn everything. I mean, I think it was Oswald Rayner that wrote that Felix effectively fired the first shot in the revolution when he fired at Rasputin, because Rasputin's death was a prelude to the revolution. But he wasn't a bad man. Rasputin wasn't a bad man either. He wasn't
evil. I mean, he was a chancer, but he was good at it.
Yeah, he seized his luck, didn't he? Let's face it. And he helped other people as well. So I wouldn't say he was a bad man. It was just a combination of circumstances, really. And I think all of the assassins, especially Felix and Dmitri, really thought they were doing a patriotic act.
That's really interesting. And kind of almost the breakdown of communication in trying to understand what Rasputin was doing there and the positive influence he was having.
Well, this is the whole problem, isn't it? It's all perceptions. It's and also as well, I mean, the ultimate problem is that Nicholas is determined to be an autocrat in the extreme, like his dad, but he's terrible at it. He's just the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time in history.
He'd have made a good constitutional monarch.
He would have been brilliant had he just had to do George V job, because he loved Russia. He was a passionate patriot. But he just, I mean, you can't be a fierce, terrifying autocrat if you're too scared to sack anyone and you'll sit down and have dinner with them and then send them a note later telling them they're fired because you don't want any confrontation.
That's right. He didn't like confrontation. Alexandra was much sterner and, you know, saying, be the autocrat, you know, this sort of thing, but he couldn't do it. So
don't even get me started on the patriarchy. Or I love this. Vanda Wilcox's little girl refers to it as the putriarchy, which is magnificent. And it's just the shaming of Alexandra that she's the bogeyman, isn't she, for Russians? She's a woman who doesn't know her place.
She is really. You know, as I said, people didn't understand what Rasputin was doing there, because they didn't know Alexei was so ill. I mean, at the tercentenary of the dynasty in 1913, Alexei had to be carried by a Cossack bodyguard because he'd had a bad spell of haemophilia a few months before and he couldn't walk.
Is that is it Naginsky? Something like that, or is that a ballerina?
No, he was a dancer, Naginsky.
Yeah, but it sounds like that. I can't remember.
There was Nagorny and there
was Nagorny, the sailor, isn't he?
Yeah, he was a Cossack sailor, and there was Derevenko, and they were the two who looked after Alexei and made sure that he didn't do too much and get into trouble. But then you've got Alexei saying, well, why can't I be like other boys? Why can't I have a bike? Why can't I play?
Injury during the First World War is why, kid.
Yeah, that's right.
You fell over and bumped your knee, and he was in agony, wasn't he? And that's one of the occasions where actually Rasputin's presence does tie in timeline-wise with an improvement in health.
Yeah, and there were several of these. So you can't blame Alexandra for believing that, you know, when Rasputin turns up, Alexei's going to get better. But the people didn't know this. I'm not even sure that Felix knew it, to be honest, because, as I said, the Tsar's sisters didn't know what was wrong until 1912. So that was Irina's mother. One of the sisters.
Was it just praying and coincidence, or did he actually have some kind of medical knowledge
I just think
it's the equivalent of homeopathic treatment, isn't it? Yeah. It's all about praying, it's all about mental well-being, but believes he's better with Rasputin around, the Emperor will do anything for the Empress, so even if he is a bit reticent about Rasputin, he's not going to make him go away, definitely.
No, that's right. Mm-hmm. And it is this positive thinking attitude, really. Rasputin comes in, don't worry, the child won't die, he will get better. And then Alexandra relaxes, and then Alexei relaxes, and then the bleeding stops. And it happened so many times. I mean, there's rumours of herbal remedies. There's stories that Rasputin was having hypnosis lessons in 1912, but he'd been at the palace a long time before that, supposedly curing Alexei, so it can't be all down to that. So there's all sorts of explanations, but I just think it's a very Russian thing that Russians perhaps understand more than we do.
I mean, it's not a sweeping statement to say Russians are superstitious.
They certainly were then,
isn't there?
don't forget, at that time, that was the time of Ouija boards and seances and all that sort of thing that was going on, and faith healers.
Arthur Conan Doyle is into spiritualism and automatic writing and all of that, isn't he? And it's certainly not just Russians.
No, that's right. It's, you know, it was a very superstitious sort of time, this pre-First World War time. So it's all to do with that, really, I think. It's that attitude.
Well, this is really fascinating. I've really enjoyed this, actually, just going over some stuff that I have a kind of inkling about and know some of the myth about, but actually kind of getting down into it and finding out about some of these other characters and what happened to them. Where can we find out more about this? The book is
Rasputin's Killer and His Romanov Princess, published by Amberley on the 15th of March. It's available now to pre-order. You can find it on the publisher's website. You can find it on Amazon, of course. So it's available to pre-order, and it'll be out on the 15th of March. So not too long to wait.
Do you do the social media thing, Corinne?
I'm on Twitter.
Sounds good. What's your handle?
It's at Corinne Hall.
All right. Well, thank you ever so much for coming on and chatting to us. Like I say, this has been really, really interesting, and I've learned a lot. I'm going to find this book, actually. I'm in trouble. I've got a big pile of books there that I need to read, but actually I find this really interesting. Yeah.
And for those who are still interested in the terrapin, he's still giving it the running man in the background in a desperate plea for attention. It's brilliant. He literally is going side to side in his tank. Hopefully, in his head, he's singing Boney M as well. Corinne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex. I've got one of your books, actually.
Oh, is it George the Fifth?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it might be.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.